This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I am Chris Policano. DC 37 is part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sundays at 8 p.m. We rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We're also available as a podcast. You simply go to the podcast app on your smartphone or tablet and search for DC 37 State of the Union. There are now more ways to stay in touch with us. You can check out our website, www.dc37.net. You can follow us on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. If you have any comments about our show or would like us to promote a community event, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. That's stateoftheunion, one word, at dc37.net. Tonight, we start the show with a discussion on fake news and its impact on the labor movement. Joining us now by phone from Washington, D.C. is Jory Craig. She is VP of GQR Insight and Action. Welcome to State of the Union.
Thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
Let's begin by asking you, what is GQR Insight and Action?
GQR is a political consultancy that focuses on public opinion research. So we care about anything that is being used to manipulate or influence or persuade public opinion. And we do research to help candidates, parties, governments, advocacy groups, and progressive organizations around the world to help navigate that.
Our producer, Rudy Orozco, was at a forum a couple of weeks ago, saw you talk about fake news, came back and said, we got to get Jory Craig on talking about fake news. So let's talk about fake news. President Trump thinks fake news is anything that, whether it's the Washington Post or the New York Times, if it's criticizing him, it's fake news. What's your take on fake news?
Right. So I was up doing this event called Unmasking Fake News up in New York. And, you know, fake news is all the rage right now. A lot of people are talking about it. As you mentioned, our president talks about it a lot. But my work started internationally, and internationally, propaganda and misinformation, disinformation, or anything that's, you know, being tried to manipulate the truth is pretty widespread. So this trend is kind of new, but the way I think about fake news is that, you know, it's not really so much about something being fake or false. It's about it being misleading. It's about information being out there, you know, with the purpose of misleading someone or harming a specific group. And so most of the most effective fake news is actually a lot of truth. It kind of just decontextualized. So that's my take on that phrase in particular.
And, you know, it sounds like, you know, George Orwell may have been right, but he was a few years too early. 1984. I mean, we really are in a world. I remember as a kid, there were three news stations on television. You may have debated about what the facts meant, but you agreed on the facts because voices of authority like Cronkite and Huntley Brinkley were telling you about this. Now we're not even agreeing on the facts anymore, and that. Has got to be part of why we're so divided in 2019.
Definitely. And, you know, we don't have just, you know, a few trusted sources anymore. There's an overwhelming amount of information being put to people, so there's tons of facts to consider. You know, a lot of the news that's out there is opinion, and when you're on social media and you're scrolling through your news feed, you're not necessarily understanding just looking at the headline and the image whether it is an opinion or whether it is actually a trusted source. And so it's gotten a lot harder for people to navigate the information being put in front of them across all the different channels they're receiving news.
And how is this being used against the labor movement, and what can the labor movement do about it?
Right. So I was actually surprised when I first started working in the States. I was lucky enough to work with the labor movement right away. And there's really sophisticated efforts being directed at labor members, all sorts of techniques on Facebook, putting in fake accounts being used to target labor members, acting like they are other fellow labor union members trying to get folks to drop out of their union, a lot of other sophisticated targeting strategies, finding labor members and spreading fake information, false information, misleading information about activities going on in the union. And so it's a pretty sophisticated network. It's very well resourced. It's very well funded. And so on the start, just, you know, talking to one another about knowing that those things are out there is one of the most important things. Getting familiar with some of the organizations that might be interested in that. The State Policy Network has, you know, more than 50 organizations that target unions pretty directly online and offline.
So say that again. The State Policy Network is an organization that has fingers in 50 states and is working specifically on sending out false information to my union brothers and sisters.
That's right. So this, think of the State Policy Network as a big umbrella organization that, you know, is sort of the parent organization of a lot of other smaller organizations that are organized on a state level. And each of those state organizations will look and feel local. So a good example, I'm from Chicago. And in Chicago, you know, the State Policy Network has all sorts of arms in the state of Illinois that push information that is against labor interests. And so, you know, they would look and feel local, but if you actually traced it back, you would see that it was coming from these resources that are specifically motivated to work against labor.
I don't want to underestimate these folks, but something I'm very proud of is that in 2008, when it was one of the lowest moments in union popularity, I think we were at 43% union popularity. Some of these groups have poured tons of money into beating up unions, and unions are more popular than they've been in 50 years. So what does that tell you?
Yeah, so it's definitely, I think everybody's trying to figure out what the impact of all these resources being spent on social media will mean. You know, across the board, people are figuring out how to most effectively use it and what impact that actually has. I think, like I said, you know, one of the reasons I said I was lucky to work with labor is because the best solution for, you know, debunking fake news or fighting against this kind of stuff is really banding together and community organizing. So the fact that you all have such a strong organizing program is actually serves as inoculation for some of the methods that they are using to try to tear labor apart. So it really is in places where the organizing, you know, movement is really strong, but these techniques kind of fall through.
And that's because there's no substituting for face-to-face contact? Is that
face-to-face contact, but also just talking with people you know. So if I'm talking, if you and I know each other and we're messaging, and I can say, hey, did you see this? What do you think?
Right.
Versus if I don't have any connection with my union and I'm not in touch with them, you know, then I might be more susceptible to hearing from a stranger if they're saying something that might resonate or might, you know, be tapping into, like, you know, something that I'm feeling or something I've heard before. So just the, you know, really keeping in touch and knowing the names of, knowing, you know, getting in person, getting offline. But then once you're, when you're online, you know, referencing back to those offline connections you have.
We're talking with Juri Craig. She is the vice president of GQR Insight and Action. We're talking about the noise that's out there that may be targeting you as a DC 37 member to get you to misunderstand your union and the labor movement in general. How much money do you think has been spent on this effort?
Millions of dollars. Millions of dollars. They're very well resourced. And we know, you know, across the board, you know, folks that have money to target labor have a lot of financial interest to do so. And that applies the same. And they're spending a lot of money online.
And they're having an effect and they have had an effect on legislation across the country in terms of trying to bust unions.
Yes. Yes, I mean it's the same groups that are doing this online activity, you know, are the same offenders that are active in busting the unions, you know, across the board.
So what should members be on the lookout for when they're online?
So the best thing to know is a lot of people say, well, I won't be duped by fake news. Well, you probably will. We're all very susceptible to it because the best kind of fake news looks pretty true. You know, it'll be tapping into something that is true, or it'll be referencing an event that did happen, and then it will slip in, you know, the false information and the misleading information. So just really understanding that if you're seeing something that, you know, is anti-union, you should question, you know, who's the messenger behind this, and what do they benefit out of putting this information in front of me? And so instead of going right to the, like, is this false or is this true, thinking about, well, who's behind this, and why might they be so focused on getting me to hear this information?
And this talk, we've only got a couple of minutes left. This talk about what we can expect in the next election cycle with all this noise that's going to be out there. What do you think about trying to get some clarity out of all the noise that's going to be made in the 2020?
Oh, that's a tough question. So there's going to be a lot of innovative techniques. One thing, the social media platforms don't really know how to handle this program. And so this problem. And so they are trying their best to combat it, but oftentimes the changes they make the problem worse. So, you know, I would say that looking at the election, people should have some trusted sources picked out that they're referencing, talk to their friends and family, you know, corroborate stories, and just make sure that they are understanding that a picture that they see in their news feed or, you know, a comment someone makes online really has to be verified. We just saw a lot of evidence around people trying to fake stories about voter fraud. We can expect to see that theme throughout next year. But I would say everyone should just be on the lookout and expect that, you know, they will come up with new techniques all the time.
Jeri Craig is the vice president of GQR Insight and Action. I want to thank you for taking the time to come out. And I'd like to talk to you some more as we move into the election season next year, if you don't mind.
I'm happy to come back. I'd love to talk to you guys. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you very much. We'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today. 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
Welcome back. This is State of the Union, the DC 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. In our final segment this evening, we are talking with Julie Menon. She's the director of NYC Census 2020. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Chris. Great to be with you.
We have talked about the census a little bit on this show in recent weeks. The census is next year. Why is it important to talk about this in 2019?
It's so important, Chris, because we've got to remember in 2010, the last time there was a census, New York City had a 61.9% self-response rate. That is one of the lowest rates in the country. And the parts of the city, such as Brooklyn, had a self-response rate of 55.5%. This basically means that so many people were not filling out the census, and with so much at stake in terms of funding, federal funding, political representation, congressional seats, we can't allow that to happen again. And that's why we as a city government are starting early, and we are all over the city trying to spread the word about the importance of the census.
And when you say that there are all these implications, let's slow that down a little bit. Explain when you say what's at stake if you don't report, what is at stake if you don't report?
Well, literally, there couldn't be more at stake. Specifically, we're fighting for our fair share of over $650 billion a year that the federal government allocates to cities and states across the country. We're in a nationwide competition for that money. That money funds everything from public education, public housing, Medicaid, Head Start, senior centers, infrastructure. It's everything. It's every important program that New Yorkers care about depends on how we do on a census. So we can't be leaving money on the table. We're New Yorkers. We can do better than a 61.9% self-response rate. And we also have to remember the politics of what's at play here. The Trump administration tried, unsuccessfully, I might add, to add a citizenship question to the census for the first time in 70 years. That question, which would have asked, are you a U.S. citizen, was a clear attempt to hurt New York, because New York, we're a city of 3.2 million immigrants. And the Trump administration tried to add the question, and we beat it back by filing a lawsuit with the attorney general, and we won our case at the Supreme Court. But what that was all about, fear and intimidation. We're not going to allow New Yorkers to be hurt by this. And that's why the most important thing that New Yorkers can do that affects the future of our city for the next 10 years is take the 2 minutes to fill the census out.
You know, I'm looking at a New York Daily News story from 2 days ago. The headline reads, "Census question about citizenship was vetted by GOP operatives who wanted to cut out Latinos, documents say." Not only did the Trump administration lie about reasons for trying to add a citizenship question to the census, but the question was vetted by Republican operatives who wanted to cut out Latinos and other minorities.
Exactly. This was a brazen political play. I mean, we got to remember what the Trump administration was trying to do. They were trying to have cities such as New York that have large immigrant populations not answer the census. Why? Because that would mean that we could lose up to 2 congressional seats in New York statewide. And it's not just about New York. That would occur in other areas that have large cities with large immigrant populations. And this would basically change the balance of the Electoral College, because Democratic progressive areas like New York City would lose congressional representation. And where does that representation go? It goes to red Republican districts across the country, changes the balance of the Electoral College, and basically changes the presidential election for years to come. So that's what this whole thing was about. And thankfully, we were able to stop the Trump administration at the Supreme Court, who sided with us that there was absolutely no legal basis whatsoever for the citizenship question.
But we must be concerned about, even though the Trump administration has been told by no less than the Supreme Court, you can't do this, there must be fear out there about what it means to be counted in the census.
Well, that's what the Trump administration is trying to do. They're trying to plan fear, but there is no reason for fear, because we have to remember, A, we won in the Supreme Court. The question's not on. B, the census is 10 questions. It asks your age. It asks where you live. It asks your gender. It asks how many people live in the home. The federal government has this information already on people, so there is nothing to fear in terms of providing the information. But why should you provide it? Because it basically determines the funding. It determines how much Head Start funding are we going to get, how many children are there in New York City. It determines senior center funding, how many seniors are there in the city. It determines public education funds, Title I funds, public housing funds. There is so much at stake. And so we can't allow the Trump administration to engage in this misinformation and disinformation campaign. We're better than that. We're New Yorkers. We're smarter than that. And we're not going to be played. And that's why we are going to ensure and go to the mat that every New Yorker is counted.
And how is
And the other thing I would mention, if I could, if I just don't want to forget this,
okay,
go ahead. So important, is Title 13 of the U.S. Code. The census is completely confidential. So Title 13 of the U.S. Code protects the confidentiality of the census. It means that when someone fills the census out, if they do it online or by phone or the traditional mail-in form, that information is 100% protected. The federal government cannot share it with anyone else. And in fact, if they were to ever share it, it would subject that employee to up to 5-year prison sentence, up to $250,000 fine. And Title 13 is really ironclad. It has not been broken since its enactment.
So how is NYC Census 2020 planning on reaching historically underdocumented communities?
Yeah, it's a great question, because we've got to remember, in 2010, the city government did not do this type of outreach. And in fact, the messaging around the census was only done by the federal government. And the messaging is fill the census out. It's the law, it's your civic duty, it's in the Constitution. And quite frankly, people didn't pay attention to that, didn't resonate. So our specific plan is we are giving out $19 million in grants to community organizations on the ground all across the city, because we know it's community organizations on the ground that are oftentimes the most trusted voice in their neighborhood. The second part of our plan is a field plan. We've divided New York City into 245 neighborhoods, and we've organized local neighborhood organizing committees, NOCCS, also called NOCs for short. And you can join your local NOCs by going to nyc.gov/census. So you can join your local neighborhood organizing committee. We provide resources, materials, training to these committees so that they can organize. And that's the other part of our plan. And then the third part of our plan is we're going to be advertising and marketing heavily across New York City, but particularly digitally, because that will have then an immediate click-through so you can fill the census out online. Now, for those that don't have access to broadband, which is actually a third of New Yorkers, we're creating access in all 219 public library branches, so they will have computer terminals and be open extra hours and have additional staff there. And then we're also going to create computer pop-up centers in houses of worship, in civic organizations, community organizations. So there'll be many places you can fill the census out. But quite frankly, you can fill the census out on your phone. You can take any phone, any device, and in 2 minutes you'll be done filling it out. And all this begins, I should add, in March.
So we've got, this is, you know, November. So in March, we can expect to see folks very visibly out there asking you to be counted.
Exactly. You will see our organizers out there. You will see our advertisements. Basically, on March 12th, the Federal Census Bureau sends out the first mailing. And if you don't fill it out the first time, they're going to send you four additional mailings. There's three ways you can fill the census out. One is there'll be a toll-free number that you can call, and in 2 minutes you'll be done. Two is you can use any computer or smartphone to fill the form out. Or three, the traditional mail-in form. If you don't fill it out by mid-May, the federal government will send someone to knock on your door. We don't want that to happen. And we don't want that to happen because that door knocker, when they knock on the door, understandably, most people will not answer the door for a stranger. So that door knocker is free then to talk to a neighbor, talk to someone in the elevator, in the hallway, and ask how many people live in that unit. And that person might say, I don't know, one person. And that door knocker can then write down one person on the form. And that, Chris, is how in 2010, over a million children under the age of five were left out of the census.
Wow.
They simply weren't counted. They were invisible. That is a tragedy and a failure. And we don't want that to happen. And it will not happen if people, New Yorkers, answer the census from the get-go in March, in April. Do not let it go to the door knocking phase.
And as you said before, New York City in 2010, 61% response rate versus the national average of what was it? It's
76%.
So we got a lot of work to do there.
Yeah, we're New Yorkers. We got a failing grade. That's unacceptable. We can't allow that to happen. We have to remember we're in a nationwide competition. We're fighting for every other jurisdiction that's trying to get its fair share of the pie. And this is money that belongs to New York City, that is rightfully ours, and also congressional seats. We don't want to lose congressional representation either, because that is, again, access to political power and resources.
Tell us again about how to contact or how to, if you want to get more involved in the census 2020, what's the best way to do that in terms of
the best
contact?
Way is to go online and go to our website at nyc.gov/census. And that's the best way, because on our site, you'll see right away, you can sign up to volunteer in your community. You can volunteer as little as 1 hour, 2 hours. You know, we're completely flexible about that. But it's a great way to be involved in the future of your neighborhood. If you don't have time to volunteer but just want to learn more about what's happening with the census and the timeline, please go on our website. All the information is there. But most importantly, in March, when you get that first mailing from the Census Bureau, please either go on your phone, call the toll-free number, or fill the form out. But most importantly, fill it out and tell all your friends and neighbors to do so as well, so New York gets its fair share.
Before I let you go, I just want to, you know, a long time ago, shortly after the tragic events of 9/11, I was working at the New York City Council, and there was a press conference one afternoon on the steps of City Hall with a number of advocates and community folks, and you spoke. And I think you were living, you lived in Lower Manhattan, you owned a business, and you didn't look as if City Hall press conferences were your natural milieu. But you, I was so struck by the passion and intensity of what you had to say. And I got to tell you, I knew at that time that we were going to see more of Julie Menin in the public service, and I was right. I feel like a scout for the Yankees who found Derek Jeter because you have served as a chairperson at Community Board 1. You've been the city's consumer affairs director. My first question, you know, was about the census, but what I really wanted to ask you about was what moved you to public service?
So, Chris, well, thank you for asking. It certainly was 9/11. I was a resident right near Ground Zero. I owned a business several blocks from Ground Zero. My business was destroyed on 9/11. My home was destroyed and we were evacuated. My husband was supposed to be at the World Trade Center the morning of September 11th. He had a 9 a.m. meeting. And at the last minute, 30 minutes before his meeting, he, unbeknownst to me, moved the location of his meeting. So I was frantically trying to find him that morning. So it literally and figuratively struck very close to home. When my business, which was located a couple blocks from Ground Zero, was destroyed, I mean, this NYPD put a checkpoint in front of my business. I just believe very strongly that I want to be part of the rebuilding. I'm a lawyer. I've been a lawyer for over 25 years, and I felt as a lawyer, I could perhaps help other businesses and residents who are grappling with the aftermath of 9/11.
Well, I got to tell you. I got to tell you, it was an impressive moment, the naturalness of your speaking. I'm sorry that we've come to the end of the segment, but I did want to acknowledge that. And Julie Menin, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Chris.
That's just about all the time we have tonight. You know, the opening of the impeachment hearings in Washington last week took me all the way back to 1954, when CBS journalist Edward R. Murrow triggered the downfall of Senator Joseph McCarthy with the broadcast of a program that blew the lid off McCarthy's demagoguery. I recently listened to Murrow's comments at the end of that show and was struck by how if you replace the words McCarthy and the junior senator from Wisconsin with the word Trump, it's as if 65 years never passed. So we're going to end the show tonight with that commentary. Take a listen. Sisters and Brothers, Edward R. Murrow, March 9th, 1954.
We will not walk in fear one of another. We will not be driven by fear into an age of unreason if we dig deep in our history and our doctrine and remember that we are not descended from fearful men, not from men who feared to write, to speak, to associate, and to defend causes that were for the moment unpopular. This is no time for men who oppose Senator McCarthy's methods to keep silent or for those who approve. We can deny our heritage and our history, but we cannot escape responsibility for the result. There is no way for a citizen of a republic to abdicate his responsibilities. As a nation, we have come into our full inheritance at a tender age. We proclaim ourselves, as indeed we are, the defenders of freedom wherever it continues to exist in the world. But we cannot defend freedom abroad by deserting it at home. The actions of the junior senator from Wisconsin have caused alarm and dismay amongst our allies abroad and given considerable comfort to our enemies. And whose fault is that? Not really his. He didn't create this situation of fear. He merely exploited it, and rather successfully. Cassius was right. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. Good night and good luck. We'll be right back.